the interruption here. You may think it's an oxymoron, but this is a very busy day in Congress.
Spoken like a former congressman.
Yeah. So we are very pleased that Congressman Joe Barton can be here. Again, he's got to get going soon, so you have his basic information in your packet. Let me just quickly quote the Wall Street Journal when they said that Joe Barton is the House GOP leading expert on energy technology. I completely concur with that, whether it is chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, ranking member of the Energy and Commerce Committee, or a member of the Energy and Commerce Committee. There really hasn't been any major legislation concerning energy in the last 20 years that either passed or didn't pass that Joe Barton didn't play a role there. And there won't be any energy legislation of significance in the near future that he's not going to play a role in. So I think it's important to hear what he has to say. He started off as a mechanical engineer, became a White House fellow in the Department of Energy, went back to Texas, and was elected to Congress in that very talented class of 1984. And has been serving.
He was elected in 1984.
It was a very talented class, as I say. And has been easily elected ever since, and will continue to be easily elected. And Congressman Paul Tonko is going to be here later today. So it's going to be interesting, I think, for folks to sort of see the difference, and hopefully some of the same. And again, I'll mention again the charge of this committee is to undertake a consensus study to determine whether and how federal policies can accelerate the market adoption of advanced energy efficiency and low or non-polluting energy technology. Maybe your answer is just no and move on, or maybe it's not. We'd like to hear from you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bart, and thank you, folks, for letting me come up. You know, this is the last day that Congress is in session for the week, and it's called a getaway day. And they promised to have us out by 3, but they know that we'd like to get out sooner. And so we actually have just finished voting, and I'm on the I've got a shot at the 12:50 flight, and I'm definitely on the 1:30. So this will not be a long speech. I also know I'm probably the last speaker between you and lunch. So that's another reason. My name is Joe Barton. I was just introduced by Barton Garden, better known as Bart Gordon. I'll tell you one real quick story before I get into my main talk. We were both elected in 1984, he from Tennessee, me from Texas. The president at the time was a man named Ronald Reagan. He had a wife named Nancy Reagan. And early on in our careers, there was some vote on the House floor, and Bart Gordon voted no and apparently said some fairly intemperate things about the president, he being a Democrat from Tennessee. Well, Nancy Reagan heard about it. But did Bart Gordon get put on the blacklist at the White House? No. Joe Barton got put on the blacklist at the White House. Yeah. And so I did a good deed, and I got invited to the White House, and the president was there, and it was one of these small gatherings, and it was not a big hoo-ha. It was, you know, just 15 or 16 people. And so I sidled up to the president, and I had been a White House fellow for President Reagan in 1981-82, and I said, "Mr. President, I need you to do me a favor." And he said, well, sure, Joe, what is it? And I said, "Would you tell your wife that I'm not Bart Gordon?" And she sent me a real nice note, and all was well after that. So I don't know what you did, Bart, but you got Nancy Reagan mad at you, and at that time that was a bad deal. I am the chairman emeritus of the Energy and Commerce Committee. I am a conservative Republican. I have been chairman. Bart Gordon was on the committee. He was also chairman of the Science Committee, so Bart and I have a good personal relationship, a good professional relationship. And apparently in this conference, you wanted somebody with an R by his name that you could look at and just kind of, when you go back home, say you saw the conservative Republican through the bars, and you know. I am not anti-alternative energy or anti-green energy. I want to say that. Senator Bingaman is a part of your group. I don't see Jeff out in the audience. But when I was chairman, I chaired the conference between the House and the Senate that resulted in the Energy Policy Act of 2005, and Senator Bingaman, along with Senator Domenici, were the two senators, Republican, Democrat, from the Senate, and John Dingell, who was ranking member of the Energy Committee, and myself, the chairman from the House, that put that bill together and put that conference committee together, conference report. So I come from a perspective that I am pro-energy, pro-all of the above, but all of the above also sometimes means some of the energy comes from below, you know, comes from oil and gas. I'm not just wind and solar and all that. When the Solyndra scandal broke several years ago, I was one of the Republicans on the committee that did the investigation that said, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. That was not a popular view in my conference. If you look at a list of the green energy projects that the Obama administration has funded, almost every one of them is either gone bankrupt or is in financial distress. Of course, you know about Solyndra, but you just go down the list, and it's one after another, including some of the big ones, First Solar, some of those, where they have huge private investment, and they're still having problems. So my first message is, I do believe that there is a role for clean. You got to define your terms, and you've got clean energy, green energy, alternative energy, and everybody has a little bit different definition on what qualifies. See, I would say that nuclear power is certainly clean energy, and could be considered green energy. And I think that natural gas is clean energy, but it's certainly not non-conventional or alternative energy. But however you look at it, the federal government has put billions and billions of dollars into the alternative energy programs, and there hasn't been much that resulted in the way, if you exclude wind power. And I know y'all probably don't want to exclude wind power, but if you do exclude wind power, the actual output in terms of energy produced is fairly negligible. If you put a market test to it, again, there's some fairly good statistics on wind power. Certainly solar power is coming down the cost curve. It's still not there yet, but a lot of progress has been made. But even then, it's on a pure market basis. It's not really competitive. So, from a political perspective, and I know you're going to have a Democrat congressman come in later on today. The good news is that for various reasons, most of the Democrats in the House and the Senate are on the side of alternative energy, however you define it, and they're one of the two major political parties in the country. So you have a base. The bad news is, most Republicans, for various budgetary reasons or scandal reasons or whatever, while we're not all anti-alternative, we are much more skeptical than we used to be, including myself. I'll tell you a little bit personal anecdote about my family. I have a son who's a Stanford MBA graduate, was a deputy assistant undersecretary or something or another at the Department of Energy for Alternative Energies. I mean, his title was just like this. And when he left DOE, he went back to Texas and signed up with a venture capital fund that was tasked to invest in alternative energy projects. But the requirements were that they had to be able to show they had the ability to make a profit within a time certain. And he kept that job for 3 years and finally resigned because he had only been able to make two investments, and they were in the millions of dollars, not the tens of millions or even hundreds of millions. And the fund, I think, had it was underwritten for like $150 billion. And that might not be right, but I think that's what it was. He made his total investments in those two projects were under $20 million. And there just weren't any projects that met the test. So he resigned. He just couldn't he couldn't find investment that met the requirements of the fund. So he resigned, and now he's starting to, he and another friend are trying to start a new fund. This time they're looking at technologies, alternative innovative technologies in the oil and gas sector. And they're apparently having a much greater ability to raise the money, and they're already looking at ways to invest the money. So my short summary is you guys have got an uphill task ahead of you, because if you look at the budget situation, we're cutting across the board on discretionary. The discretionary spending at the federal level is going to be less than $1 trillion this year. And it's down. It's going to be one of those times where we're actually below what we were last year. Not too many congressmen on either side of the aisle or senators feel like the energy programs are essential programs. So I would suspect that there's going to be a lot of budgetary pressure. And so as you folks go through your methodology, this is a time, I think, to hunker down and really look at the practicalities. Don't look for headlines. Alternative energy, green energy, clean energy, however you want to define it, does have a role. We have, certainly Bart would say this as a former chairman of the Science Committee. One of the things the federal government should do is invest in basic research, and I think you can still make the case for some of the photovoltaics and the cellulosic biomass and some of those things, that there's some basic research that does have potential payoffs on down the road. But when you start going into the commercialization phase and some of the DOE alternative energy programs in the last 2 to 3 years have really tried to hit a home run on the solar side or the battery side, it's not working. And you've got, when you invest $3 billion and you create 20 jobs, that's not a good political headline. So the last thing I just saw, and Bart's probably going to get mad at me, we are not going to put a price on carbon. It ain't going to happen. There is no way. There is no way. And that's regardless of who's in the White House. And I mean, I guess if you had an absolute electoral sweep in 2 years or 4 years and you had 70% Democrat majorities in the House and the Senate and a liberal Democrat president, then maybe you could do it. But it'd be debatable even then. So I wouldn't put a lot of effort into trying to determine. In fact, we're going to go the other way. This social cost of carbon that the Department of Energy is beginning to use and EPA is beginning to use, you're going to see some oversight and investigation letters coming to those guys. If they haven't already received them, they'll be receiving them in the very near future. So with that, on that down note, I'd be happy to take a couple of questions.
Well, I think you communicated in less than 10 minutes what I couldn't have done in 2 or 3 days.
And that's not true.
So that was some credit. So any question? We'd like for you to make that 250. I know what it is. Joe has
I will make it.
Young children and a wife at home.
You have a question? Can you use the microphone?
I've never been in this building. It's a nice building, isn't it?
Congressman, I'm...
It's nice, though.
Congressman, I'm John Mizrock. I had the pleasure and privilege of working with your son at DOE.
Oh, okay.
Last administration.
Well, then you know what his title was.
I did. But we won't go into that because it's just too long.
Yeah. at least it shows I'm telling the truth. I do have a son. He did work at DOE, and he did work in alternative energy.
And thank you for coming today. The country has seen the biggest, probably most disruptive swings in energy prices in the modern era. In 2006, spot market price of natural gas was $15 an MCF.
Good old days.
Oil was going up to $147 a barrel in 2008. And we had an imperative, apart from greenhouse gas issues, national security and economic security, because we were importing about 67% of our oil. That figure's down below 40%.
Right.
Gas is, you know, $2 to $3 or whatever.
Natural gas, per MCF.
Of us still feel we need to get to a lower carbon future, whether that's...
I'm not opposed to that.
The 5 years we thought we had in 2006, or maybe the 15 or 20 or more years. So the question is, how, from a congressional point of view, particularly in the House, how can the renewable industries and these newly rebounding fossil fuel industries and Congress and the administration collaborate to get us to this future where we have alternatives? What's the best way to, you think, to do that in the near term and in the long term? Is that,
I think there is a consensus on both political sides to reduce emissions. You don't have to be a believer in global warming or climate change, whatever we're calling it these days, to want to get greater output for less input. And you can also be a supporter of moving from coal to natural gas to nuclear or solar or wind where it's appropriate. So I don't think there's any opposition to that. But be careful of specific targets and federally mandated standards. I'll give you an example, the renewable fuel standard. We put a federal RFS in the Energy Policy Act of 2005. Denny Hastert was the speaker. He was from Illinois. He was a supporter of corn-based ethanol. I was the chairman of the committee from Texas, and I was trying to protect MTBE from lawsuits and things like that. So the compromise was a 7 billion, it ramped up over time to, I think, 7 billion gallons of corn ethanol. The market could absorb it. It helped an industry at the time we thought was fledgling. We put all kinds of incentives in for biomass and cellulosic. Well, Republicans lost the House. Pelosi became Speaker, and you had the Energy Act of 2007. I voted against that one. I'm sure Bart was probably pretty instrumental in its creation. I mean, he certainly would have been in a position to do so at the time. But it took that $5 to $7 billion gallon mandate per year and upped it over time to $36 billion. And that was based on gasoline consumption going up. So you put these requirements by refinery, by source, and they're all these mandates are going up. Well, gasoline consumption started down for lots of good reasons. So you now got a mandate that can't be met. Can't be met. And everybody acknowledges that, at least off the record. But there's this, you know, we've got the standard, you've got to meet it. So we're holding hearings. I'm on a bill to repeal it. But even if we don't repeal it, it's going to have to be changed. So to go back to your question, you don't do your industry or your projects or your programs too much good over the long run if you put in mandatory positions that don't have any chance of ever meeting some sort of a cost-benefit or market-based test. So be a little bit more flexible. You can set your aspirational goals, and I think both political parties would be okay with that. But when you lock in specific targets, specific numbers, if they're totally out of touch with where the marketplace is, it's going to cause a problem, and that's what you're seeing right now on the ethanol situation.
One more question.
We got two. I'll give short answers.
Hi, I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consulting engineer. What research and development objectives seem like they will help?
Oh, my. Research. Well, I'm still a believer in some of this battery technology. Even though it hadn't panned out yet, the potential is still there. I would be supportive of that. I still think cellulosic ethanol makes a little sense if we can ever get it going. And apparently there's a plant down in Mississippi that's about to, you know, they're always about to get started, you know. But apparently this one is about to get started. And while it's a little bit off subject, I don't think natural gas prices are going to stay $2 to $3. So at some point in time, nuclear power is going to become viable again, I hope, from an economic standpoint. From a political standpoint, we've kind of passed the political test on nuclear. But now the market test isn't there because natural gas is so cheap. So some of the stuff into some of the new reactors and the reprocessing and some of that would be things I think we'd still support.
Congressman, for coming. I'm Ted Roosevelt. With my last name, I suppose I should make it clear that I'm an Oyster Bay Roosevelt instead of a Hyde Park Roosevelt.
I think Roosevelt's a great name. I'd almost trade names with you. Just, you know, I think maybe it'd be a little better for me.
But thank you for your transparency. Certain things are clear and not going to happen, at least for a while. Carbon tax. How do you feel and how do you think the House would feel about master limited partnerships being used for renewable energy?
I don't know enough about master limited partnerships to give you a definitive answer, but if they're legitimate mechanisms, I think we'd be okay on that. I mean, I'm not. Tell me what a master limited partnership is.
A master limited partnership is an organization which is actually used a whole lot in pipelines, in the fossil fuel industry, in which you don't pay a corporate tax. And all the income flows down to the individual investors who are primarily retail investors, but they obviously pay income taxes on what they earn. The cost to the Treasury tends to be relatively low. There's probably 500 to 600 billion of these outstanding, used a lot for financing, let's say, pipelines in the fossil fuel industry. And it's a very inexpensive but effective way of raising equity money primarily by going to the retail market where you're dealing with predictable cash flows.
Based on that, I'd say we'd be supportive. I'm not on the Ways and Means, so I don't know too much about high finance, but that sounds reasonable. Anybody, there was one more over here, and then I'll get going.
Mr. Congressman, I'm Bill Ritter, former governor of Colorado.
Oh, wow.
Colorado State University.
That's where my brother taught at Colorado State, and my other brother graduated from Colorado College. And I had an uncle who was a professor of history at Colorado College and an extremely radical liberal Democrat.
we'll take all stripes in Colorado. Listen, the question really is about whether there's any appetite around tax reform as it relates to energy policy. So we use, you know, on the renewable side, we use ITCs and PTCs, and there's a debate about PTCs that's kind of ongoing, year-to-year management of the wind industry with the PTC. There's arguments against doing that year-to-year because of what it does to market uncertainty. But the question is really, is there any appetite at all, do you think, in the House to look at all sort of energy tax policy, energy tax credits, and try and use some different standard than whether it's politically popular, just eliminate all and kind of start from scratch and say, what do we really want to incent? What do we want to do from the beginning? What, you know, what needs the sort of help that a tax credit might give it to gain market share? And what needs sunsetting? What needs to go away? Is there an appetite for that?
Again, I'm not on the Ways and Means Committee, so that's a little out of my league. But the short answer is it could be if you don't get too greedy. We talk about tax reform all the time, and we almost never do it. And so as a part of the debt ceiling deal, if there's going to be a debt ceiling deal later this fall, Dave Camp, the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, is talking about a grand tax reform in a big package. I don't think that's going to happen. But I do think, and I'm not even sure there's going to be a big debt ceiling deal, but if there is, there will be a tax component to it. And that could be a part of it, again, if it's not excessively self-serving. We're serious in the House about reducing the budget deficit. That's not, and that's not made for TV serious. I mean, it's grassroots, fed up. A lot of young congressmen have gotten elected to get this budget under control serious. And so you're, but something like that has enough potential in the long term. The less political you make it, probably the better, would be my general advice. But I think it's possible. People like you supporting it would certainly be a help, I would think. Well, I'm going to go catch an airplane. But thank y'all.
So, as I was saying, a carbon tax is necessary. but sufficient, and there are many other things that we should be trying to fix. And one of the points which I've summarized on this chart in the electricity sector is the inefficiencies that are built into the current regulations and pricing structures there. And some headlines are just, as I gave you before, this range of numbers that are implied by the value of energy. And this range of numbers is hidden in the regulations. It's very hard to see this. You have to extract this information. People can't take advantage of these price signals. The way the rules particularly work, particularly with respect to reliability, is that they get smoothed out as to and flattened so that everybody pays the same thing every hour, even though the values might be quite different. And this has enormous impacts on valuing all kinds of technologies, not the least of which are renewables and batteries and the like. On the second point on real-time pricing, there's a time of use rates is a topic that people talk about all the time in the electricity sector, particularly for the retail and household sectors. But what we have almost ubiquitously are flat rates, FR, as I refer to them here. So you charge the same price every hour no matter what they're doing. But the actual costs of electricity generation are highly volatile and vary from hour to hour. There's all kinds of approximations that are suggested, like peak pricing. That's the PP that you see up there, which is a little bit better. So you pick the time of day where you think that the prices should be higher because the peaks are there. Critical peak rebate is similar to that, where you pick a time of day where you pay people money not to consume if they don't consume during that time. Critical peak pricing. And finally, there's real-time pricing, where you actually charge people the marginal costs as we see them today. And what I think people don't appreciate is how much of a gap there is between the efficient way to do this, which is real-time pricing, and these average price mechanisms. So the picture I use on the right is something I used when I gave a talk in Newark a couple of years ago, and I updated it just here because I was wanted to get more recent data, but it's essentially the same story. And Newark is in the PJM electricity market system. There's a generator right there in Newark that you can go get the price at that location for every hour. And so this is a graph of the price of electricity in Newark for every hour during the month of February in 2013. And then I ask you to look at that spaghetti diagram and tell me when is the peak period. And if you were trying to set the prices a month ahead, a year ahead, through regulatory processes, when should you make them high and when should you make them low? And as you see, you can't even tell. It varies depending on the conditions in the system, varies dramatically. Sometimes the prices are even negative at that location because of transmission constraints and so on. So we have a huge opportunity to improve the efficiency of pricing. And somebody who had an efficient battery technology might be able to take advantage of this volatility, but they can't do it if the rates are flat over this kind of time frame. So there's a big challenge there, independent of the externalities. And then finally, I want to make... Huh? Okay, do you want me to stop? I will. I will come back to the question of other externalities later. Thank you.
Well, we're getting the yin and the yang here today. You have Congressman Paul Tonko's resume in your booklet, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time. But if you looked at it, you would find that there is a common denominator all the way through, and that's energy. He was in the state legislature in New York State for 30 years, including being the chairman of the Energy Committee. He was also CEO of the New York State Energy and Research and Development Authority. He was an engineer by trade. Upon coming to Congress, he was a member of the Science and Technology Committee and a member of the Energy Subcommittee. Now he's on the Energy and Commerce Committee and is very knowledgeable in the subject. And I think also, you know, I don't want to romanticize the old days or about Congress, but really, Paul Tonko is the kind of congressman that makes you proud that he's serving you, that he has an integrity, a demeanor, an opinion, but a willingness to try to compromise with others. So I'm very pleased that he can be here. As I said earlier, Joe Barton was a little earlier, and one of the things I said about Joe was that there's not going to be any significant legislation that's going to pass Congress anytime soon that he's will not support, and I think it's the same thing with Paul Tonko. Unless those two get together, there won't be significant energy legislation in the near future. So thank you, Congressman, for being here.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And as I was welcome with those very generous comments, let me thank Bart Gordon publicly for being an awesome chair. When I came into the Congress and served on science, space, and tech, one could not ask for a better coach, a more generous colleague who allowed me much latitude on the committee. Forever grateful. And Bart, you're a consummate statesman. And we're lucky to have you involved and invested in the energy world yet today. I often said that when he and Ranker Ray Hall were the Republican and Democratic leadership on that committee, with Chairman Gordon serving as the chair, I often felt that they should have charged. Because not only was it interesting to watch how this technical, tough stuff got done, but there was so much immense humor involved, which I still to this day don't understand in a committee like Science and Tech, but much humor. When Texas versus Tennessee, it's a rip-roaring time. I just want to thank you all for the opportunity to participate here this afternoon. What you're dealing with is an important topic. The best ideas and technologies in the world are of little value unless they are put to widespread use. And we are in this time crunch, I believe, to really move forward effectively, efficiently, so as to engage a lot of the potential out there. We're in a global race on innovation and clean energy, and this nation, with its intellectual capacity, has tremendous potential. But there are things that I believe the federal government can step in and help resolve, where we address perhaps the risk factor or need to prime the pump or lead by example. There's a soundness and a justification for federal involvement. A number of things that the federal government does to speed deployment of clean energy and energy-efficient technologies. Regulatory policy can pull technologies forward when the existing market forces are simply not aligned yet to do that. The energy efficiency standards for major appliances, for example, that the Department of Energy establishes and the Energy Star program that encourages companies to earn that label and that informs consumers about the ongoing energy costs associated with an appliance's usage have both made important contributions in the deployment of energy-saving goods. The vehicle fuel efficiency standards that EPA had instituted have made a tremendous difference in the consumption of transportation fuels. I don't think these things would have happened nearly as fast in the absence of regulations setting the targets and the timetables. Of course, things do not always go as we hope. The Energy and Commerce Committee has been examining the renewable fuel standard. And in fact, we had an extensive hearing this week. We didn't get the assumption right, and it seems to be causing problems. And there was some angst, much angst, being expressed from the legislative side of that exchange about people not being rigid and having to open up to some sort of adjustments so that we can grow forward in a productive way. At that extensive hearing this week, we heard from many significant parties. We didn't get the assumption right, and it seems to be causing problems. We assumed fuel demand would continue to rise, and as we know, it didn't. And we were overly optimistic about the development of cellulosic biofuels. It is likely that some adjustment will be required here if EPA does not have the flexibility to adjust to the present situation. Federal funding to support directly the deployment of technologies remains a major concern. For example, the Weatherization Assistance Program, administered by DOE in partnership with the states, is another great program that has tackled one of the toughest problems in the deployment of any technology, the high capital cost of equipment and that related cost of installation. Tax policy and federal procurement policy are also extremely important tools that can be used to accelerate deployment of energy technologies. Tax policies and programs like the Treasury's 1603 program that provides rebates for installation of eligible energy technologies has been very popular and has promoted strong growth of small companies in the early stages of their firm's development while solving problems and lowering government operating costs. The federal government makes a lot of purchases every year, ranging from fuel to vehicles to paper to machinery, and the list goes on. It also has a substantial stock of buildings located across this country. Using the federal building stock as a showcase for green building materials, energy-efficient equipment, and renewable energy installation provides an early market and real-world test for technologies and products and helps them to gain acceptance into the wider market. And, of course, the investments made by the federal government in research and development are essential. I watched as we put together an energy bill recently, as we dealt with that appropriation bill, which, by the way, took us to 1977 levels for DOE. A rather telling statement, a rather discouraging statement with an upsetting tone. And in there was this attack on ARPA-E. The establishment of the new Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, or ARPA-E, has added a whole new dimension in the toolbox. And to now defund it drastically is, I think, very disturbing. It has fostered cooperative projects with academic, with federal and private sector researchers, pushing forward cutting-edge ideas with an eye toward the marketplace. Having a research and development portfolio that covers the spectrum from basic sciences to technology development is a big step forward. Testing and deployment greatly augments the work being done by the private sector and in the university community. Sustained support of these efforts is essential to lowering costs and improving performance of energy technologies. So there is a partnership that is real, that has a tremendous track record with DARPA before it and now ARPA-E, where we incorporate academia along with public and private sector to make great advances. I have run through a number of different types of policies here. Many of these have worked well. They can be made more effective. Sustained support that keeps us moving forward is what we need. The federal government should be leading in some areas, and we should be evaluating the state programs and applying the successful models on a broader scale through federal policy. I mean, that's leadership. That's taking that step forward that advances the goals and the vision of this nation and pulls us in the right direction. The study you are undertaking provides an excellent opportunity to catalog and evaluate these different instruments and provide us with some recommendations to move forward. You will be that, I think, push that we need. You'll sharpen that vision to a laser-sharp perspective and then demand of us, I hope, the sort of attention and policy and investments that are required to maximize our leap forward. Again, we're in the midst of a global race on clean energy, innovation, high tech. It is not our bit to fail. It's our challenge to come to the race fully prepared and bulked up with the essentials. So I look forward to seeing the outcome of this endeavor. I thank you for your participation and the time and energy you're pouring forth so that we as a nation can prosper. And I look forward to being part of that shared opportunity here where we inform and educate and inspire together. I'm open to that learning curve. And in this room are those minds that can sharpen and expedite that learning curve. So I thank you very much. And there is a role for federal government. I'm not one of those that believes it should be removed from our existence. I'm one that believes we need to refine, go forward with a comprehensive energy plan that this nation drastically requires, that is constantly updated and routinely implemented. That's us at our best. That's us in a significantly scientific way. And I think, Bart, you were probably there when we shook hands with Neil Armstrong in 2009 as we celebrated the 40th anniversary. That brought it back in crystal clear vision for me. I remember being touched by those Kennedy years and the wisdom of us dusting off our backside from a Sputnik moment and saying never again and moving forward in a way that impassioned our efforts to invest so that we could be that nation to land that flag on the moon. And to shake Neil Armstrong's hand 40 years after the experience reminded me we're in a similar journey today. Where's the passion? The passion is in this room. If we can't ignite that spark on the Hill, I'm going to reach to this group to inspire and to inform and educate and lead. Thank you so much.
Congressman also is on the way to the airport, but I have time for a couple of questions if anyone has some.
Anyone, or it doesn't have to be a question, it can be a comment, maybe a shared experience that you've developed here. Yes, sir.
Hello, I'm Steve Schwarber, working at McGuire Woods law firm right now. You touched upon the fact that we're in a global race, and obviously America historically, look over our history, what's really driven a lot of our prosperity has been enhancements in technology and infrastructure. Intercontinental Railroad, highways, automobile, and all that. Mm-hmm. There's been it seems that there's a disconnect now, and maybe the Republicans and some certain parties aren't realizing that investing in the next generation of technologies, whether you're for carbon emission reduction or not because of global warming, that's actually going to affect our economy longer term. What sort of messaging and what sort of work's being done more behind the scenes from those who are for investment in the newer technologies to kind of get that message across and say, look, no, this is about an economic issue. This is about prosperity and jobs, right? And kind of what's going on more behind the scenes or publicly to really get that message across? Because I think it's something that's being lost in the debate.
I think you're absolutely right. And there's no denying there's great polarization. And some of those who want to emotionalize the labeling out there say that many of us in government are for socialization. Government involved in every bit of life and to a far too great an extent. But you just need to bring back history and remind people that, look, the development of an interstate highway system was, if it was a socialization program, served us well. the development of a railroad network and a canal system, all served us well. So, you know, that's been there since day one. And for people who try to theorize the purest capitalist model, they just need to be corrected by looking at what's happening in other nations. But to your point, what can be done? Because people are coming in as disbelievers or discrediting data that's compiled out there that are very important bits of information. Those data are serving us, should serve us well. I think what we need to do is boil it down to the simplistics and get to that lowest common denominator. For instance, with carbon, with global warming, carbon emission, climate change, if we can put it into the context of pollution, if we can put it into that context, I think we can get senators and reps alike, we can get Republicans and Democrats alike, to agree that none of us stands for pollution. I mean, nobody wants to tell their community, I don't care how conservative it is, nobody's going to want to tell his community, her community, I stand for pollution. If we can agree to the fact that we want to solve pollution, that's our first step. Boil it down to the simplistics. And I think so many have labeled the end result already and they polarize without ever having the dialogue. And I think we need to sit at the table and say, look, there's pollution out there, do we agree? And I would suggest the great majority would have to say yes. And then we break it down. Okay, what's our solutions? You know, otherwise we're kidding ourselves. And as this global race passes us by, we don't have the luxury to play with the time, with the clock. We have to be invested, we have to be ready to go. And what I see is a huge delay tactic going on the Hill that I can't support. And I will work in any clever fashion you can imagine, I can imagine, to work in a bipartisan, bicameral way. Because I really truly believe that America is requiring us to resolve this given struggle so that we can move forward as we did in the 60s. And we did it in exemplary fashion after a huge setback. So it's almost repeat scenario. But boiling it down to the simplistics, I think, might get us there. Yes, sir.
Congressman, thank you for your remarks. I'm Peter Rothstein with the New England Clean Energy Council. And a neighbor of New York and collaborator with New York on many efforts. So a question is, how much do you see the opportunity or need to do, you talk about actually a fairly broad energy agenda. Where do you see the need or opportunity to do something that is that broad versus something that is looking at where are some of the success and progress is happening today? And much of it is in the states. I mean, the majority of states with RPSs and, mm-hmm. and experiments with energy efficiency and Con Ed doing microgrid experiments in New York City. How can the federal government be a partner to the range of things that are going on in the states and the regions and with public and private partnerships that might, you know, build the groundswell of success stories, which then could be broadened and shared through common practices?
Well, I think that, you know, individual states are doing things out there. I know New England has been cutting edge. New York has been cutting edge. We just got done debating the coal ash legislation moments ago. And, you know, my amendment that got defeated would allow EPA to enter in. This is all about discrediting the EPA, but it would allow the EPA to come in where there are contiguous states or states impacted by some resource that connects them, a river flowing through it from states away. That's justified, in my opinion. I think, you know, a fifth grader, you know, being smarter than a fifth grader or dumber than a fifth grader, I think a fifth grader would say, yeah, I can understand that connect. So setting standards, providing flexibility, and uniting us in a way that saves us from those states that are being defunct is how we ought to see it. And I think there are plenty of examples out there that we can offer that should serve us as rationale to move forward in a comprehensive strategy. And this whole trend to say government's gotten too big, it's involved in too many things, go tell it to these nations that are bulking up and their government is telling them everything. They're not deciding much on their own, and so we have to put it into perspective.
Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Rob Williams, University of Maryland, Resources for the Future. I wanted to ask a question about sort of coming back to the possibility of a price on carbon or something like it. Representative Barton, who was here before you, said there is absolutely no way, no how, that we are ever going to have a carbon tax, cap and trade program, anything that's putting a price on carbon. So sort of a two-part question. First, would you agree with that, or do you have a more optimistic view? And second, if we're not going to have a program like that in the near term, what might be a politically viable compromise? Would it be something like a clean energy standard or something like that? Are there other options that are out there? Sort of where might that compromise come from?
Well, Rob, I disagree with the representative. I think that some measure out there to require us to assist in the carbon cleanup, like a tax, is an important thing. You know, some clean energy standards that can guide us as we move forward are essential. You know, many are suggesting 2017 is a threshold year. Others will take it to 2020. I'm really concerned about the very laid-back attitude we've had about global warming. And, you know, for the staunchly conservative or extreme, because I wouldn't want to offend any conservative friends by labeling them with some that I see on the Hill these days, who in my opinion are extreme. But if you want to talk wastefulness and you want to talk getting rid of the cost of government, well, let's sit down and talk about disaster aid. I mean, I've watched what New York and New England, Peter, have done with Superstorm Sandy. Superstorm Sandy is a huge price tag, and we need necessarily to talk about not just rebuilding, but reformulating our response because of the drastic toll that was taken on these communities and lessons that hopefully were learned. But the loss of life, of property, of businesses, of houses, you know, how do you put that into a context that allows us to avoid that cost and invest in the cost of carbon cleanup? There is that linkage that has to be made with that damage, Mother Nature invading the Northeast. I'm 170 miles, 80 miles north of New York City with my district. We had tropical storms, hurricanes, tornadoes, atypical for that region. Loss of lives again, erosion of farmland, very valuable farmland, loss of businesses. This is a disaster aid requirement now, and it costs us dearly, and still people aren't brought back whole. So, you know, we know from data compiled again and put it in the ecosystem category, but we're getting exponentially more rain over the Catskills, the southern mountain chain beneath my district, than we are in the northern chain in the Adirondacks. Now, that those data are compelling. For us to ignore it, fine. But don't complain when you have to pay the price of cleanup and disaster relief. So it has to be put in the big picture scenario. And the problem I have is that so many times we're siloing our discussions so that we talk about a narrow bit of the pie when we should be talking about the full picture. And there's a lot of, I think, good that can come out of us opening up with honest-to-goodness conversation. With that, because so many of you call our office or are concerned with the issues that we deal with energy and commerce, Clinton Britt is our chief of staff. He's in the back of the room, and maybe just a quick introduction is a good thing. And Jean Frucci is our legislative director, formerly with the Science, Space, and Tech Committee. So I'm happy to have an opportunity for the three of us to appear today. Okay? And thank you for your valuable input and your time and energy spent so that we can leap forward. We desperately have to do that. And Chairman Bart, always a good thing to see you.
Thank you.